It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. No, actually, it was just the worst of times. The most nightmarish and traumatic years of our lives. A quagmire of debilitating despair sucking the life and soul out of us all. Or, as it is more commonly called, high school. Sounds like it's time for episode 44 of Pop Art, the podcast where my guest chooses a movie from popular culture, and I'll select a film from the more art classic side of cinema with a connection to it. I am your Aloha, Mr. Hand host, Howard Kasner. Today, I am happy to welcome back previous guests, fellow podcasters Anna Kaiser and Derek Danke, who have chosen the Amy Heckerling Cameron Crowe 1980s classic Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and I have chosen the Peter Bogdanovich Larry McMurtry 1970s classic The Last Picture Show, both about teens navigating the difficult years of high school. To begin, Anna and Derek, why don't you remind our audiences something about yourself?
Thank you so much, Howard, for having us on the show again. This is
Yes, thank you.
We just had the best time last time. And like you said, we're fellow podcasters. Our show is also a film-centric show, 80s movie montage. So yeah, Fast Times, 80s film. But that made it all the more enjoyable to get to watch something outside of our normal wheelhouse with Last Picture Show.
Yeah, same as last time we were on. It was great to talk about and watch one of our favorite films from that 80s era and see the contrast with that other film. And the prior case, Silence, in this case, The Last Picture Show.
Mm-hmm. Great. With that, let's get to your selection, and that is Fast Times at Ridgemont High. First, some information about the film. Fast Times at Ridgemont High is an American film released in 1982. It was directed by Amy Heckerling and written by Cameron Crowe, adapted from his 1981 book, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, A True Story, when Crowe went undercover at Claremont High School in San Diego and wrote about his experiences. It stars Sean Penn, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Judge Reinhold, Robert Romanus, Brian Becker, Phoebe Cates, Ray Walston, Scott Thomas, Vincent Schiavelli, Amanda Weiss, D.W. Brown, Forrest Whitaker, Eric Stoltz, James Russo, Nicolas Cage, though at that time he was billed as Nicolas Coppola, and Anthony Edwards. The story revolves around a group of teenagers at the fictional high school Ridgemont High as they navigate issues of sex, drugs, and rock and roll while working at the local mall and trying to pass history class. Why did you choose this film?
I think how we've already put it forth, we love 80s movies, so that we knew that we were going to pick something within this decade. Personally, I love the teen film. The 80s is when that genre really took on a life of its own and became a known genre. I think a lot of people, myself included, typically associate the teen film from that decade with John Hughes. So I thought it would be interesting to discuss something that actually precedes his teen films by a couple years and has had just as much lasting power.
And I would say that all the Hughes teen films have a similar theme or feel to them. I don't know if I particularly enjoy it or if it's meant to be enjoyable, but some other teen films, Fast Times in particular, leaves without a lot of resolution, and you get this slice of what life was like for these kids. And it's not necessarily great. It is reflective of the hellscape you just described of getting through high school. Watching it more recently, I had actually underappreciated just how bleak some of their lives were.
Yeah.
Well, we'll certainly get into that. That is a theme that is usually part of teen films that a lot of people I don't think really realize. But when did you first see the film?
This falls into the category of I saw it way too young. I could not peg specific year or age, but I know I was a kid. Probably saw it at some point in the later 80s. It's just one of those movies where it's just been part of my consciousness for virtually the entirety of my life. Spicoli, that's a name, and that's a character that I've always had in my head. And for better or for worse, the scene where Stacy loses her virginity has been imprinted on me the entire time, too, along with the iconic song that goes with it.
I definitely didn't see it that young. I probably was in high school. I honestly don't think I particularly liked it a whole lot the first time I saw it, because unlike some of the other teen films, like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, for example, where it's really fun, there are fun moments in this, but there are also soul-crushing moments like the virginity losing scene where it ruined a song for generations.
I don't think I saw it actually when it first came out, probably because it was a teen comedy and I was way beyond teen years, but I'm sure I saw it around that time. When I first saw it, I was actually rather surprised at what I would call the honesty of it. Mm-hmm. You mentioned John Hughes. John Hughes doesn't do much for me with his teen comedies. I think they're rather safe. I call them Norman Rockwell. Fast Times at Ridgemont High was one of the very first films that took a more frank look at what teenagers were going through. It was one of the very first teen comedies. Because of this, we eventually have things like American Pie and, of course, Clueless, because Amy Heckerling later directed Clueless. So I was quite struck by the sexual frankness, which I want to say is very unusual, but we'll get to Last Picture Show and find out that it was pretty sexual.
Yeah,
indeed.
The similarities are pretty amazing.
What are some of your favorite scenes?
Hands down, my favorite scene is when Stacy, she tries to convince Brad she's going bowling. That's when she goes and gets her abortion. She comes up with an excuse to let the nurse let her leave. And then you see that Brad realized what was going on and he waited for her that entire time. Obviously, it's a sad part of the film that this 15-year-old freshman is having to get an abortion. But I found it so lovely, this really quiet moment between siblings. I think you're right. The film as a whole shows a frankness and a realism to these years. I think I could say the same, that John Hughes doesn't have that same take on everything. A really poignant moment. He's asking her, who did it to you? She's not going to tell him. He accepts that. The scene ending with, are you hungry? That really twists my heart.
That Mike Damone guy, I didn't like him at all.
No.
A couple favorite moments were more towards the end. When Mr. Hand shows up at Spicoli's house to go through the course, part of me was yearning for some other wholesome moments of any possible source. So I did enjoy that. I liked seeing Brad get his moment of redemption. Favorite moments all involve Spicoli, because Spicoli was there with the iconic, all right, Hamilton.
The second one you mentioned, of course, is the robbery at the end, right? That is also one of my favorite moments, too. My other favorite moment is one that certainly everybody remembers, and that's the pizza delivery scene.
Yeah.
But I love any of the scenes that Ray Walston is in, because I think he steals the movie, perhaps even from Sean Penn.
They're great together. That's why the other favorite scene was when they go through that final. So Spicoli had wasted 6 hours of his time. So he spent 6 hours going through the course with him, I guess.
Ray Walston has always been grateful for this movie, because before this, he was primarily known as being in the TV series My Favorite Martian.
Yes.
When anybody saw him, that's all that they would talk about. And he knew that his life had changed when he would be out and people would say, Aloha, Mr. Hand. And he said, oh, thank God, I left My Favorite Martian behind.
What a different character that was.
But you talk about the abortion scene. One of the things that surprised me at the time is that nobody talked about it. I mean, no one protested the movie. No one got upset. Mm-hmm. I sometimes wonder if the people who would be upset about it didn't even know that it took place, because it's not a movie that they would go to see. It's handled in such a realistic way. Before this, the biggest pop culture reference to abortion probably was the series of Maude, where there was a two-part episode where she has to decide whether to get an abortion or not. And that was very controversial. Connected to that, I can't say it's the first time, but it's one of the first time that I actually saw masturbation dramatized on scene.
Great comic effect. That was something I was thinking about, too, is that you have a couple of these fantasy scenes. They're specific to Judge Reinhold's character and Sean Penn's character. And I just thought that was interesting that two of the male leads, they focus on these alternate fantasy lives that they envision. You don't get that with the female characters.
That is true. Another area, which I was now going to bring up, and this isn't actually the movie's or even Amy Heckerling's fault. All the nudity is female.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's not so much surprising that there's no male frontal nudity. This was a time, if you were an actor, you were going to show your bare butt on the screen. Women showed their breasts, men showed their bare behind, even if it was Michael Douglas, unfortunately. It was sort of a rite of passage, often to very good effect, I might say. There were a lot of really good rear-end scenes. So I was surprised there was none of that. But yeah. I was bothered at the time that all the nudity was female. And I was so surprised because it was a female director. But in her defense, she did want male nudity. I think they even shot a full frontal scene with Mike Damone when he's having sex with Jennifer Jason Leigh. And they show both of them completely naked and how uncomfortable they are and how odd it is and how weird it is. But they had to cut that because otherwise they would get an X rating. Someone said it was either that or the carrot scene had to go.
I'm trying to put myself in Amy Heckerling's shoes, so to speak. It's still in some ways a pretty big deal, unfortunately, when there's a female director of a mainstream movie. We're talking almost 40 years ago at this point. I didn't actually know that she had attempted to bring some male nudity in it. Had that been the case, that could have been more effective because it would speak to what you were saying in terms of just the awkwardness.
Yeah.
Again, that through line of showing the reality. One thing I appreciate is she's certainly not putting a rosy lens on these sex scenes.
Neither of the movies we're going to be discussing.
Right, right. So I really appreciate that. And I think what didn't sit with me all too well was that we are talking about a character who's supposed to be 15 years old.
Yeah. It seemed, with it being oddly one-sided, exploitive thing to do.
The way that the camera lingers on her after intercourse is finished and she's watching him get dressed, I had uncomfortable feelings around that. As far as Phoebe Cates, her nude scene, I guess I give a little bit more allowance to it because it is coming from the perspective of Brad. It's Brad's fantasy.
Yeah, it is exactly what it is supposed to look like.
Yes. It's not something that puts me off the film, but
you know, that scene is showing up and you're like, oh God.
Exactly.
And it does show the double standard at the time, because if they had included full frontal of a male, it gets an X rating. If you have full frontal of a female, it gets an R rating. People have gone after the ratings board because of how they decide what gets an R and what gets an X and what gets a PG, and that it's sometimes based on racist and homophobic issues. One of the things I thought that was interesting about the movie is that there's an hierarchy at the mall. You know, Phoebe Cates and Jennifer Jason Leigh, they're very proud that they work at the most prestigious restaurant. And Judge Reinhold is very happy that he is working at the best fast food place. One who works at the movie theater says all the fun is on the other side.
No, I thought that that was fascinating. I mean, that's one of the things that really draws me to the film. It's not that they're just showing the authenticity of what it might be in their romantic lives and their friendships, but also these are working kids.
Yeah.
It definitely speaks to a teenage mentality, the way that they say, I'm at the cool place to work.
That felt as real to me as any of it, because when I was in high school, this one guy works at Cold Stone Creamery. That's a pretty cool job. This guy works at Little Caesars. Not a cool job, but we might be able to get free pizza from it if we show up when they close.
And I thought it was so interesting, too, that towards the beginning of the movie, Stacy and Linda, for that matter, and all the other girls that work at the pizza restaurant have eyes for the guy that eventually does take Stacy's virginity. But then after the fact, when he ghosts her, Linda is trying to comfort her and she's like, do you really want to be dating a guy who works at a stereo sound shop? Shaming him for that. It's fine if you're a teenager, but if you're in your late 20s and you're still working at the mall, then that's a whole nother story.
Apropos of that, there was a scene, and I don't think it was shot, that explains why she got ghosted. He calls her home and it's revealed that she's only 15. And with that, he doesn't contact her again.
Okay.
Because I wonder that too. Did they ever see each other again after that?
I never thought he believed her in the first place. But plausible deniability, because she's telling me she's 19.
That's not going to hold up in court.
Right.
Yes. But speaking of that, because I do think that this, like The Last Picture Show, captures teenage life at a very particular time and a very particular place. I was never part of the mall culture. The mall culture came after me. Did you all go through that?
Yeah, I think so. Where I grew up in Glendale or Phoenix, Arizona, there was one main mall that people would go to hang out. And it was, if not exactly on point, pretty close to what you would see in Fast Time.
Yes and no for me. When I was junior high, high school, there was a mall culture, and that is what we did. We would go to the mall. Parents would drop us off. We'd hang out there for sometimes, if it was a Saturday, all day. It was a little bit different because I did work during high school, but as a babysitter. So like, I didn't experience the mall culture from the point of view of being an employee of one.
My friends and I were mostly just freeloaders, and we would try to create this network of people that worked in different jobs at the mall.
Get free stuff from them.
Exactly.
I remember reading an article about this. These people are middle class. They're not even working class. It was analysis of teenagers in high school working. The odd thing was they really didn't have to work, but they would do it to make extra money. It was just expected, I think, more by their friends than by their family.
especially when you look at Stacy and Brad's home, they seem to have a pretty nice place where they live. They have the pool.
Yeah.
Everybody's coming over to use their pool. And
their parents are always out of town.
Oh. Yeah, they're doing okay. And I totally agree with you that they're doing it to feel some greater sense of independence. There's a really, really brief scene where you see Damone leave his home. He looks like he's maybe a touch more working class. He was coming from an apartment building.
Well, his job is basically scalping tickets.
Yeah, scalping tickets.
And we can now talk about who our favorite characters are and what we think of the characters. But Brad is kind of a doofus. We laugh at him. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, in many ways, he is a very good worker and he's working to pay for his car. Meanwhile, Stacy, who tries to get money from Damone to pay for the abortion and he doesn't come through, she does have enough money to pay for it all on her own. They are very responsible people in many, many ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what are some of your favorite characters?
I probably gravitate towards Stacy and Linda. Linda's a really interesting character because she is the self-appointed love guru for Stacy. And she has, and she has no idea. Constantly giving Stacy bad advice when Stacy tells her, "I'm still a virgin. Oh, just get it over with." That kind of stuff. But on the other hand, what I really appreciate about Linda is she is so fiercely loyal to Stacy when she's ghosted. Then when she is again ghosted by Damone, Linda takes it even further. Graffitis his car, graffitis his locker.
Right.
So she's this really great friend to her in some ways, and this really bad mentor in another way. For Stacy, her story is heartbreaking, but she goes through a really substantial character arc. She goes from this girl who is young, really inexperienced. She is following what she thinks is the right advice. And through a couple really significant experiences that makes her grow and change her opinion about how she wants to conduct her private life and comes out of it seemingly healthy young person who wants to take it slow and get to know somebody.
She has a real rough go of things.
Yeah.
For
yeah,
a lot she of does. The movie. And that's why my favorite character is Jeff Spicoli, because he's low key one of the most brilliant people in the movie. When he wrecks that dude's car and then has it parked out in front of the school to make it look like the other high school ruined it. Genius. I love that moment from him because he's this obvious dumb stoner, but that was a pro move.
He's everybody's favorite character, and he's probably the best acted. You're right, he is very brilliant in the way he handles that car. He unfortunately has the one line, of course, they would never get away with today. What I'm a little surprised is no one seems to regret it who was involved in the film, in the fantasy sequence when he calls some people fags.
Yep.
And yes, I understand that Cameron Crowe even has that line in some sort of picture on his wall. I'm sure at the time, I don't know how it affected me then, but this time it just goes, oh, well, times have really changed, haven't they?
It's crazy how we watch all these movies and you forget. It's really interesting the significance or how things like that stand out now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know what my thoughts were the first time I saw it, if it even registered in my mind. But as soon as that scene happened, Anne and I looked at each other. We're like, holy cow.
Yeah. And it happened so quickly that I was like, wait, did he just say what I thought he said?
But there's one interesting thing about the acting that will also parallel The Last Picture Show. It's amazing how many of these cast members went on to big, big career. You don't see very many movies that have this many basically unknown actors go on to something really big afterwards.
And that's something that we joke about because we actually have not covered Fast Times on our show, but it is referenced a lot. One thing that we joke about is just everybody's in this movie, even to what I've heard, he was meant to have a bigger role and they just for time had to cut it down.
To some degree, that might have been his own fault. He lied about his age. He was 17. Everybody else is 18 or older. And that's very important when it comes to scheduling, because if you're under 18, there's a lot more restrictions as to how many hours these people can work and when they could work, because this was often filmed starting at midnight.
Mm-hmm.
So the scene where Damone sells tickets to the two young teens, they had to do that really quick before midnight.
Okay.
Nicholas might have hoisted himself on his own petard because they found out that he really wasn't 18.
You can get in big trouble for that. I mean, it's the same thing as what we were talking about with plausible deniability. It doesn't matter if you're underage or underage. But between him and a couple other actors who have had great careers but don't really have a lot to do in this movie, few years removed from this movie. Eric Stoltz is doing Mask. Anthony Edwards is doing Top Gun.
And Forrest Whitaker, you know, initially Oscar. James Russo and Jennifer Jason Leigh just skyrocketed.
She had the right. Dante dropped it, Fred, and Gremlins.
But she eventually decided she didn't like acting. Moved to New York, opened a boutique, married Kevin Kline.
Living her best life.
She seems to be very, very happy. So I can't It's also amazing when we get the Last Picture Show. The same thing, it happens. It's really astounding what can happen if you have the right casting director. And if you have an eye for actors, like Amy Heckerling does. Have you seen very many Amy Heckerling movies?
Of course we exclude. Yeah, outside of those two, I knew that she had in her later career, she's greatly pivoted towards television. She's been directing
a great number of the Red Oaks. A lot of independent filmmakers and directors of the 1990s ended up directing a lot of the episodes from Red Oaks.
Now that I'm looking at her page, remembering that she did European Vacation, so of course we've seen that.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of that one episode of The Office she directed.
So she definitely has done really well for the projects that she's been a part of. She absolutely has been a pioneer for female directors between her and Martha Coolidge. There's nothing that could be done about it now. I just wish that they both had actually been given more opportunities.
After Clueless, she does direct three movies that I've never heard of. That's Loser, I Can Never Be Your Woman, and Vamps. And sometimes when you get a series of movies in a row that don't really work out, then it's harder and harder to get projects going. So you often go to TV, and we'll be also talking about something similar happening to Peter Bogdanovich. What about you, Derek?
I know that I've seen it. I can't really remember it, but she also directed Johnny Dangerously.
And Johnny Dangerously, I don't know why. It's an awful movie, and I watch it all the time.
We all have those movies.
I think my favorite of hers is probably Clueless. I really know how much I should talk about National Lampoon's European Vacation just because I find it the weakest of the vacations.
But one thing also, Amy Heckerling is a very solid director. She makes movies that are often very effective. They're often fun. She doesn't particularly have a look, vision, or a style that anybody can point to. Maybe to some degree, much of the success of the film may be more due to Cameron Crowe, who wrote the screenplay and then went on to direct some very interesting movies himself.
It's fascinating to see where his career has gone and the fact that he was more so a journalist before he ever entered the film world, almost famous based on him and his experiences. I think it's not too controversial to say that great movie usually has a great script or great source material. That's on him and the work that he put into the book that eventually was adapted.
And I suppose we should mention that there is a great soundtrack here.
Oh.
Yeah, there really is.
Fantastic soundtrack. That's something that I think is just really fun. It's lasted. I think you could see probably filmmakers, studios have seen the effectiveness of having a strong soundtrack to go along with teen films because then teens are going to buy those soundtracks. It really taps into the pulse of that era.
I like the end credit song, the Goodbye from Oingo Boingo. Yeah. That's one of my
Danny
favorites.
Danny
Elfman.
Yeah. We'll start segueing into The Last Picture Show. One of the things that the two films do have in common is that in many ways, if it wasn't so funny, it would be incredibly depressing. Roger Ebert was one of the critics who was not a fan of the film. He thought it was a terrible, terrible film. I think he gave it one star. He said it was basically sexploitation and that there's no joy in the sex. The sex is all very negative. And it's true. There's no sex in it that's particularly sex positive. I think that's true of a lot of these high school coming of age.
They're not ready to go to that level of intimacy, at least for Fast Times. That's so clear is that they think that they have to do it because
peer
pressure. This is how I show that I'm growing up. I definitely understand the criticism, but I think that was just one aspect of what these teens went through in their daily lives and something that they had to try to work through to get through school.
Love Roger Ebert. Agree with a lot of what he says, but I really pretty strongly disagree. What does he want as the alternative to show these really amazing sexual encounters between kids? That is much worse. I think the film is really effective in showing that this isn't awesome for these kids. I'm more offended by films like Porky's.
With that, here's some more information about the movie. It cost $5 million to make, and it made $27.1 million. It was a very surprise hit, and in fact, the producers and distributors didn't have a lot of faith in it. They were just going to dump it on, I think, just the West Coast and have it show in a relatively few places. It got such good word of mouth that they opened it across the U.S. and made $27.1 million. In 2005, the film was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. The character of Mark Rat Ratner was modeled on the student Andy Rathbone, who became friends with Cameron Crowe. Today, Andy Rathbone is known for writing Windows for Dummies.
Wow.
That's amazing.
And 50 other computer books. He was actually not that happy with the way he was portrayed. He considered himself a lot cooler. In fact, he was one.
We all do. Yeah.
But he was the one who ordered the pizza for class in real life.
Interesting.
Other people who actually appeared in this movie were Martin Brest, who soon afterwards directed Beverly Hills Cop, sports broadcaster Stu Nahan as himself. He appeared with Spicoli in the fantasy sequence. Yeah. Taylor Negron as the pizza guy. Pamela Springsteen, sister of Bruce. Wow. Lana Clarkson, the future murder victim of Phil Spector. Crowe's future wife, Nancy Wilson of the band Heart. And producer Stuart Kornfeld, who had produced The Elephant Man and History of the World Part 1. The movie was filmed at Van Nuys High School. The mall was the Sherman Oaks Galleria, which apparently today bears no resemblance to the way the Sherman Oaks Galleria was at the time the movie was made. This was Nicolas Cage's first paid role. And the role of Mr. Hand was originally offered to Fred Gwynn, but he turned it down due to his objections over the tone and sexual content in the film. And I do wonder, though I haven't read it, whether in South Park, the teacher's puppet is called Mr. Hand.
Yeah.
And I often wondered if that was a reference to this movie.
It's got to be, right?
Well, with that, let's go to my selection, and that is The Last Picture Show. First, some information about the film. The Last Picture Show is an American film released in 1971. It was directed by Peter Bogdanovich and written by Bogdanovich and Nuri McMurty, adapted from the semi-autobiographical novel of the same name by McMurty. It stars Timothy Bottoms, Jeff Bridges, Sybil Shepherd, Ben Johnson, Cloris Leachman, Ellen Burstyn, Eileen Brennan, Clue Gallagher, Sam Bottoms, Randy Quaid, Gary Brockett, Sharon Taggart, Mark Doyle, Bill Thurman, John Hillerman, and Frank Marshall. The story revolves around two close friends and the woman who comes between them in 1951 Texas as they attend their senior year of high school in a small dead-end town, navigating sex, friendship, and country music while trying to figure out their future in a town that has no future. What do you think of the pairing of the two films?
It was perfect. There are so many parallels between the pairings of characters and what they're going through. No, I thought it was a great match.
I did too. These two have similarities between them, in particular between the journeys, to some degree, of Jennifer Jason Leigh's character and Sybil Shepherd's character. And this idea of these really big ensemble casts.
Yeah.
Where you're weaving in and out of different characters' lives, getting, again, a little snapshot of where they are at particular places in the movies.
I would argue that there was possibly a bit more optimism in Fast Times.
Yeah. A lot more optimism in Fast Times. When did you first see the film?
Last night.
Yeah. Less than 24 hours ago.
Yeah, this is a film that I knew of. I've actually listened to podcasts about the film, was familiar with the cast in it, but just had never had an opportunity or just never happened.
And I knew nothing about it. I probably had to ask you the name of it several times to make sure that I was getting the right movie. I just went into it completely blind, not really knowing exactly what the connections would be, how it was going to match up with Fast Times.
And what did you think of the film?
I enjoyed it more than Fast Times.
That's allowable.
I feel like I should, almost, because it was just such a well-made movie with some great performances. There were extent that we felt uncomfortable during some of the sex scenes in Fast Times. I felt like my skin was crawling during some of the moments in The Last Picture Show. But when I look at the aggregate of everything that was put together for that story, I found it a really great story. Some of the characters, Sam the Lion, that character was amazing. He was great. So yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Like I had mentioned, I was aware of the film and I knew it had this reputation around it. after having seen it, I was like, okay, I get it. I get why this movie is so beloved and why it's also just so respected for many things, the least of which is the acting. I think Bogdanovich was up for Best Director for this, and it had a host of Oscar nominations. Sometimes you like the polished, glossy Hollywood whatever, but I really appreciate the rawness of this. And in particular, although I know that there is a greater focus on the teen characters and their journeys, I really loved, in particular, the older women that are portrayed in this film. I was captivated anytime I saw Eileen Brennan or Ellen Burstyn or Cloris Leachman on the screen.
Leachman at the end.
Oh,
that final scene when she just lets loose on Sunny was amazing.
Amazing.
She did that in one take and without any rehearsal with Peter Bogdanovich. She wanted to rehearse it. She asked Peter Bogdanovich, can we rehearse it a few times? And he says, no, I just want you to do it. I want to see it raw. And she just does and gives this amazing performance. When it's over, he says, well, you've just won the Oscar. At the same time, even today, she says, I wish he would have let me do it again. I could have done it better.
That must be an acting thing where they're just always, nope, give me one more try.
I saw it around the time it came out. It might have been the very year it came out. I was in college. It really resonated with me because I grew up in Texas. I didn't grow up in as small a town as this was. I grew up in Corpus Christi. But one of the things that always identified with this is this town is nothing. It's boring. There is nothing there for these people. And that was me growing up. I grew up in Corpus Christi, and I say it's the most boring town on the face of the earth. And I felt the same thing that these characters did. There just isn't anything here for me. There's no future. It's much worse for them because most of them didn't have a way out. Sybil Shepherd's about the only one. I do think it's one of the great American films. So I was really quite impressed with the film. This is probably my fourth time for seeing it. What are some of your favorite scenes from the movie?
If you don't mind, Derek, going off of what you said, and I already mentioned in general all the scenes with the older characters. In particular, I love Ellen Burstyn because she goes so against what I would think I would see in a mother character. You think that she'd be telling Sybil Shepherd to mind her purity and to save herself for her husband, especially in that era. To see her, well, we can get you to the doctor, we can get you some birth control, we can, you know, I thought she was amazing. I was in love anytime I saw her on screen because she brought a total freshness to that type of character. But outside of that, to Derek's point, Ben Johnson, there's this groundedness and this integrity to Sam the Lion's character. I really didn't know the storyline at all. For instance, when we saw the scene where the boys are trying to get Billy to lose his virginity, we were both like, what's happening right now? And didn't know if there would be any repercussions for it. And so the following scene, when Sam the Lion is really handing it to them and saying, like, didn't even have the decency to wipe his face. Oh, that line just did it for me. Loved anything he was in.
One of my favorite scenes is Sam and Sonny at the watering hole where Sam is telling him that story when he was younger with this young woman and how in love they were and how crazy they were. Ultimately, we find out that that's Louis Farrow, so Ellen Burstyn's character, which made perfect sense. But I love that scene, and I love that after Sam has passed away, you find out still who that was because it ties different elements of the overall story together. Anything that he was in is probably a tie for my favorite.
Speaking of the losing the virginity scene, that is one of the major changes from the book, because in the book, they actually go out and have sex with a heifer. It's not with a prostitute. And Orson Welles talked Peter Bogdanovich out of that. So they came up with this scene, which I think probably, at least for a movie, was a much better choice to make.
I think so. It's already a difficult scene to watch.
Yeah.
I certainly agree with the highlights being Ben Johnson, especially his monologue, and then Cloris Leachman's final scene. They're often what I call the money shots. And by that, I mean, if you're going to win an Oscar, it helps to have that one scene. They both have this one scene. Ben Johnson has this monologue, and then you have Cloris Leachman's scene at the very end. And that's what sealed the deal to get the Oscar. The other one of me that was really big at the time is the swimming pool scene. I had seen sexual frankness like this before, but still the sexual frankness in the movie was relatively new, especially when it came to teenagers. I assume you saw this all on TV, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think there is one thing that is a little different. One thing here, you do get to see rear nudity. So
a lot of butts.
We see some buns. Yep.
But the first three times I saw it, you actually see the top of the penis of the character who is holding the swimming pool get together.
Oh, okay.
Which was very shocking. You don't see everything. You just see the very top. I think somehow by transferring it to TV, they cut off a little at the bottom and a little at the top. So you don't see it at all.
I feel like I see a flash of Randy Quaid's pubic hair, which is a sentence I never thought I would say.
It's probably a sentence Randy Quaid thought he would never hear anyone say.
That scene is interesting on a lot of levels. I'm not sure what I thought I should expect from a movie from the early 70s. I was very surprised that that scene made it into the final cut. You know, we were cast the Hays Code and that sort of thing. You see a quick flash of Sybil Shepherd when she finally takes off her bra, but they cut away multiple times to everybody else at the party just watching her. And they're all already completely nude. Yes, you have some blocking choices where the men are covering themselves in certain ways, but I still was really surprised for a film of that era.
It wasn't even the fact that there was nudity, obviously, and all throughout the scene, but there was just something about the tone that was set in that entire sequence. I think it was intended to make you feel uncomfortable, and it succeeded greatly.
For me, it was both very exciting and very uncomfortable at the same time. It's like, oh, this is very uncomfortable. Gee, I wish I was there. But it should be noted that when Sybil Shepherd undressed, there was nobody else around except for Peter Bogdanovich, the director of cinematography, and one other person, which was often very unusual when filming women getting undressed. They weren't always so discreet.
Right. What I appreciate about that scene, if we're going to do a direct comparison to Fast Times, they portrayed that scene in a much more realistic way than the sex scene between Stacy and Damone. If you're going to portray anything of that nature, in terms of what we were discussing with the effectiveness, show both of them to show the awkwardness, to show the discomfort that they have with themselves. Whereas in this scene, they're all having this party. So if they only had cutaways of the nude women, I'd be like, what's going on right now?
This was a time when movies were changing in the U.S. Postmodernism was becoming part of the way that movies were made. And by this, I mean that this was the first era in which filmmakers were really, really influenced by earlier filmmakers. It's not that people before hadn't been influenced by films that came before, but this was the period when, not just in the U.S., but all over the world, that filmmakers grew up watching movies, not just watching movies, but watching and watching and watching and watching movies. Not just the great films. They would watch the B films and things like this. They went in two different directions. You had the more existential filmmakers like Scorsese, Woody Allen, Paul Schrader, and Robert Benton, who were more influenced by the French New Wave and Italian neorealism and other European filmmakers, as well as Kurosawa in Japan. But then you had a set of filmmakers who were more influenced by earlier American filmmakers. That would be people like De Palma, Spielberg, Lucas, and Peter Bogdanovich, who was a film scholar before he made films. He wrote books on Ford and Howard Hawks, Alfred Hitchcock, became friends with them, would interview them. So his films are heavily influenced by Howard Hawks, John Ford, and Alfred Hitchcock. And in this one particularly, heavily, heavily influenced by John Ford and Howard Hawks. If you've seen a number of Ford and Hawks movies, you just see these incredible panoramas with scenery in the background, pure Americana in black and white, which was also a decision that Orson Welles talked them into. So it gives it a different tone. It makes it even feel more nostalgic. It makes it feel like it does belong to an early period in 1951. Have you seen many of Peter Bogdanovich's movies?
Of all his films, the one that I'm most familiar with is Paper Moon.
Yeah, I was going to say the same.
Yeah, you know, I mean, in fact, we own it.
I'm kind of surprised, but that's what everybody says. I always expect people to say, "What's up, Doc?" But yeah, they're more familiar with Paper Moon than The Last Picture Show.
He's really, I would say, an actor's director. He gets great performances out of his actors. This is not to take away at all from just the innate talent that Tatum O'Neal has. But for him to get that performance out of her, and she won her own Oscar, is pretty incredible. In terms of What's Up, Doc, although I've only seen it a handful of times, but to get Barbara Streisand, to get that kind of comedic performance out of her, that is not what I usually associate with Barbara Streisand. Mm-hmm. I do think you can absolutely see the influences on his work at the top of our conversation when you were talking about how he got the opinion of Orson Welles in terms of, do a scene this way or you're this way. The fact that he had such a close relationship with somebody who is arguably called a cinematic genius, there's a lot to be said for his collaboration with Polly Platt, who was his wife for a while, and they continued their professional collaboration afterwards. Sometimes she is not acknowledged in the manner that she should be. They really worked together so close. I personally think he did his best work when they were still together. So the fact that his acclaim tapered off once they finally separated speaks to maybe the influence she had on him.
I'm less familiar with his work than that. The only thing that I commented on while we were watching it was that there were some parts of it that almost reminded me of like a Wes Anderson film.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not surprised to have later found out that that is probably one of Wes Anderson's influences, Peter Bogdanovich. So that is the beginning, middle, and end of my familiarity with Peter Bogdanovich.
It's interesting that you mentioned Polly Platt. Peter Bogdanovich started out very well. If you've never seen Targets, which is a Roger Corman film, a very low-budget film with Boris Karloff, it's about a horror film actor who's going to make an appearance at a drive-in where they're going to show a couple of his films. A sniper shows up and starts shooting people. It's very unnerving because the sniper doesn't really have a reason for doing it. He has mental issues.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very effective first film, and it's got his name out there. He made then three, I think, good films. After that, The Best is the Last Picture Show, but What's Up, Doc, which is always very, very watchable, and Paper Moon, which seems to be everybody's favorite. But then his career, sort of like Amy Heckerling's, really started going downhill or really didn't go anywhere. I think it's after Paper Moon. He makes three movies in a row that are huge bombs. Two of them are with Sybil Shepherd. Sybil Shepherd, to me, is always the weak point of The Last Picture Show. I think she's a horrendously terrible actress. If you see films with her after this, she's terrible. She's not even that good in her television series. She's only good because it's written specifically for her so they can play up.
Bruce Willis.
I feel like you're targeting Moonlighting specifically now.
Oh, I'm sorry. Actually, it's not Moonlighting that I'm thinking of. She did Sybil. Well, the main reason why Moonlighting works so well is, let's face it, Bruce Willis is in it. Just something happened to Bogdanovich that is the biggest mistake I always say filmmakers should never make. If you're a male filmmaker, if you're sleeping with an actress, don't cast her in your movies unless she's a good actress. He does Stacey Miller trying to make her a star, and she just doesn't have the acting ability to remotely be able to carry that movie. A Long Last Love was in the book, The 50 Worst Films Ever Made, which has been updated for 50 years, so who knows where it is now. And then Nickelodeon was also a big bomb. Sybil Shepherd broke up the marriage of Peter Bogdanovich and Polly Platt. It gave us the movie Irreconcilable Differences through Barrymore, based on Bogdanovich-Platt marriage. And then he couldn't seem to get a hit. He made one really good film, St. Jack, that the critics love, but the public didn't. After he broke up with Sybil Shepherd, he became involved with Dorothy Stratton. And then she was, of course, killed by her husband, which was very traumatizing for him. Mm-hmm. So I think all of this made it very difficult for him to ever come back, do the kinds of films where he had the control over what kind of films he wanted to make.
Can't say that this is a film that I would be like, let's put that on. But, you know, he did direct Mask, and it was an interesting film. Great performance by Cher and Eric Stoltz for what he had to do with that character. Sure. I like Noises Off.
Everybody
funny movie.
Loves Noises, but it bombed. So.
Yeah, I know.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
If I loved The Last Picture Show, and I did love it, should I just not watch Texasville?
So I saw it when it came out. It's pretty bad. I actually think it starts off in a very, very wrong way, because this town is dying. You get to Texasville and Jeff Bridges is a millionaire, but he's having trouble and is about to lose all his money now. So the town never died. Cloris Leachman is his secretary. Timothy Bottoms is having mental issues. And Sybil Shepherd returns to town after being gone for a very long time. And my memory is when Jeff Bridges goes out to meet her, she says she doesn't remember him. And I'm going, no, I don't believe that you don't remember him. The most interesting thing about the movie is that everybody gathers at the Dairy Queen. I think that really showed how times had changed, that the Dairy Queen was the big area for people to meet. Peter Bogdanovich claims that the reason is because it was taken out of his hands. He didn't have the final edit. This really wasn't his vision. But Larry McMurtry did write the book. He didn't write the screenplay.
I agree with you that I think Sybil Shepherd's character would remember the guy that needed two tries to take her virginity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As far as her performance in it, I can't say that she was a character that I gravitated towards, but I felt like that was intentional on the part of the filmmakers. I can't say I've seen a lot of her work. I think I caught some episodes of Moonlighting when I was a kid. I'm just not really familiar with anything else that she's done. If she's not a really competent actress, especially the company that she was surrounded with in this movie, I think it worked for that character only because she's selfish, she's shallow,
manipulative,
but also naive and also a victim herself.
She is.
So I felt, okay, I buy into this.
You can often tell when an actor or actress isn't that great. What usually happens is they make a comeback on TV and a television show specifically written for them.
Yeah.
I think like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, to a great degree, it's the screenplay that really puts the movie over. And another way that it parallels it is in both films, there really isn't a plot.
Mm-hmm.
It's what's often called episodic.
If I'm being honest, it's a touch frustrating because I'm used to seeing closure and completion to character arcs. Again, with Sybil Shepherd,
she's gone.
She's just gone. She's just absent from the last bit of the film. Same thing with her mom. Again, I'm completely invested in some of these characters and I don't see closure. I mean, she kind of has it, I suppose, when she's having that conversation with Sunny and it's the acknowledgement that she was the person who was in love with Sam the Lion. But I don't really know what happens to her. I guess she just goes back to her unhappy marriage. But on the other hand, I really like that we jump around from character to character. I think it's really interesting what they do with Jeff Bridges' character. It's very prominent in that first part of film, and then he's gone because he goes off and I think gets some kind of a job. That's how he gets his car. And then he's back again, and then he leaves again because now he's enlisted. I found it very different than what I'm used to with the lack of handholding in terms of progression of time. Like all of a sudden you just hear, I've been gone for a couple months, or so-and-so has been gone for a year. It's been whatever, you know, even when the two boys go to Mexico and then they come back and Sam the Lion has died. I thought that that was a really compelling part of the film where you don't know where you are from scene to scene.
I don't think it takes place just over a span of several months.
It goes from October to November of the following year. I had the same issues with Fast Times at Ridgemont High, where all of a sudden they had great leaps of time. That is one of the issues that film has. For example, books don't. It can be very difficult to convey passing of time in movies.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell that it was near the holidays, your Christmas time at one point, and then graduation. You had some idea of how much time was passing, but I thought, okay, Jeff Bridges is in this. He's probably going to be the main character that I'm following. And clearly he wasn't. If that's anybody, it's Sonny. But even from him as point of reference, it just evolves to other things that are happening within this town.
There's only one part of the plot that I never understood. I never really noticed it actually before until this. That is when they're discussing the will of Sam the Lion. Mm-hmm. And they said he left $1,000 to Joe Bob, who is the preacher's son. And they say it as if there's supposed to be some significance to it. But I never know what the significance was supposed to be.
They didn't bring it up in a way that it was supposed to mean something.
Again, maybe one of the frustrations that I had with the film is that particular character. We get this real quick glimpse that he is potentially a pedophile. And then that just goes away. He kidnaps this little girl. I think somebody very casually says, oh, he just took off her underwear.
Yeah, they didn't really give a shit.
Yeah, they didn't care.
I think there's one aspect of the film that doesn't age well, because you're right. It's already out of prison and he didn't do it. Get her to take off her underwear. I'm going, no, he's a pedophile. He's going to do this again. That is an area where they had a different attitude back then.
And as far as the $1,000, I don't know.
I wondered if he was supposed to be his father.
This was this known secret. It seems like everybody knows each other's secrets. I mean, it kind of becomes a joke.
And he says, does everybody in this town know? Well, yes, everyone knows. Your car's out there for a long period time in front of that. What do you think they're going to think? Should be noted, they did not film a couple of scenes, but the implication is supposed to be that Cloris Leachman's husband, who is the coach, is homosexual. And there were a couple of scenes written, but they did not film, that made that clear, especially in its relationship to the quarterback at the very end. The quarterback, who's supposed to be now the big savior of the football team, because now they have a good football team, is the one that the coach hits on the backside in basketball.
Okay, got it.
But that's one of the reasons why the character is very unhappy in her marriage, is her husband is homosexual.
Other than her line to Sonny saying, "You really don't have any idea of what's going on."
Yeah.
But I didn't really know what that meant.
The only clue I had was when he hits the guy on the backside and the guy looks at him a little funny.
Howard, I'm curious, what do you think her appointments were? Because it seemed like she came out of that first appointment that we see her go to very, very upset. And Sonny even thinks that there's some like health something going on. But is she going to some kind of therapy session?
That's a good question. I thought it might have something to do with change of life, which means can't have children. But I don't know. But I often thought for some reason it had something to do with her having children. When she takes on Sonny as a lover, she's always mothering him.
Yeah.
It's very edible. What did you think of the technical aspects of the film, the cinematography, the production design, everything like that?
I loved it. I was paying close eye in particular to the design because I knew that Platt was behind it. I knew that she had gone out and scouted, and I thought that what they came up with so effectively showed what that town was like. It certainly looked like a dying town. As far as the cinematography, you don't see a lot of films in the 70s in black and white.
The pool hall itself looked completely dilapidated. Between that opening shot of their main street with the theater, everything about it, it was quite grim.
The cinematographer was Robert Surtees, who is one of the grand old cinematographers of the golden era of Hollywood. This may be his best film, but he is probably most celebrated for Ben-Hur.
Oh, okay.
I find it very bleak, but incredibly beautiful at the same time.
The other scene that really struck me as being intentionally shocking was the moment where Sybil Shepherd's character goes out with the man that her mom was having an affair with. Everything about that was horrible, and it was shot in a way that it felt horrible. We talked about this with both movies. There's not a single enjoyable act of sex in either of these movies.
It's certainly not a shot for shot, but boy, if Amy Heckerling was influenced by any scene for Stacey's virginity losing scene, I feel like that might be it.
I think the word I'm looking for is gross.
And I think based on what you're saying now, you must have seen the director's cut.
Oh.
Was it around 2 hours and 5 minutes?
Yes. That sounds right. Yeah.
I saw the director's cut this time, too. I'd never seen the director's cut before. The scene in the pool hall where he has sex with her is not in the original. It's just before and after.
Okay.
Some other scenes that weren't in the original, when they're going to the picnic. When I saw it this time, I said, I don't remember that scene. But that's where Sonny starts crying when he sees the fishing area. The scene where they decide to go to Mexico was not in the original, only when they go up to him and say, we're going to Mexico.
Taking off.
There are a few other scenes like that. In propos to this, what we've been talking about, how grim it is, Roger Ebert gave the film 4 out of 4 stars. He named it the best film of 1971, and he put it on his great movies list. But what he wrote, and I think this is very true, the film is above all an evocation of mood. It is about a town with no reason to exist and people with no reason to live there. The only hope is in transgression. And I think that kind of sums it up.
That's what I was saying. I usually agree with Ebert.
And we do, again, have to mention, like in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, the number of people who went on to bigger careers. What's interesting is that both the young stars and the old stars, with the exception of Ben Johnson, who had been around for a long time being a stuntman and playing a sidekick to John Wayne, were still new. Ellen Burstyn and Cloris Leachman and Eileen Brennan were really mainly known for a long list of television roles. One of Cloris Leachman's most famous was in the classic Twilight Zone episode, It's a Wonderful Life, with Billy Mumy as the kid who wishes people out into the cornfield to get rid of them. But all of these people, this was their first major, major break, no matter their age. A great deal of these people went on to huge careers. Jeff Bridges, Ben Johnson, Cloris Leachman, Ellen Burstyn all got Oscars at some point, and Eileen Brennan and Randy Quaid got Oscar nominations at some point. So someone knew what they were doing.
I recognized Eileen Brennan from The Sting.
I always remember her from Private Benjamin, because she got the Oscar nomination. most people know her from Clue, as well as Murder by Death. But in closing out on this, maybe we could talk about high school movies and these coming-of-age movies in general. They're often so incredibly successful, but they're often so depressing and humiliating to the characters. Even if you don't realize it while you're watching it, Fast Times at Ridgemont High would be so depressing if it wasn't so funny. What do you think is the appeal?
Look, I don't think most people had a clueless experience when they were in high school. No. That was a very unique world. But there's a universality about it. Everybody has had a high school experience.
Yeah.
Everybody's had crushes. Everybody's had embarrassment, friendship, strife. Those are the things that draw adults to it, maybe in a way where they're going back to a nostalgic place. But at the same time, I said to Derek last night, I was so glad I'm not in high school anymore. There's that duality to it. For the teen films that are more appropriate for somebody who is still a teenager, there's a relatability to it.
Gives a voice to what they're experiencing. Yeah,
to what their experience is.
With that, here's some more information about the film. It cost $1.3 million to make, and it made $29.1 million. It was a very big hit that year. It received 8 Academy Award nominations for picture, director, screenplay, cinematography, and 4 supporting acting nominations. Johnson and Leachman, who won. It was the 4th movie in which both the supporting actor and supporting actress came from the same movie. And then Jeff Bridges and Ellen Burstyn, who didn't win. At 9 minutes and 54 seconds, Ben Johnson's performance in this movie is the shortest to ever win an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. And the movie also did very well when it came to the New York Film Critics Association and the National Society of Film Critics. Jimmy Stewart was first offered the role of Sam the Lion, and I think he would have been great, but he had a TV show commitment and he did want to do it. Ben Johnson actually didn't want to do it. He kept turning it down. I've heard 2 different reasons for it. One is he didn't like the sex and the language in the film, but apparently the real reason is there are just too many words.
Too many words.
So Peter Bogdanovich went to John Ford, and John Ford went to Ben Johnson and said, do you always want to be known as being John Wayne's sidekick? So with that, Ben Johnson decided to do the movie. Peter Bogdanovich told both Ben Johnson and Cloris Leachman, if you do this movie, you're going to win in the Oscars for it. And he said, that sounds like a story that's been made up. And no, he really did. In 1998, the Library of Congress selected the film for preservation in the United States National Film Registry as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. It was Sybil Shepherd, Randy Quaid, and Sam Bottoms' movie debut. And I'm sure many of you recognize the English teacher, John Hillerman, who later became famous for playing Tom Selleck's sidekick in Magnum P.I.
Higgins.
Derek nailed that.
So with that, let's start closing out. And I asked you to choose a film or 2 to go with your choice that might interest our audience. So take it away.
I think if you enjoyed Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you would probably also enjoy Dazed and Confused, mm-hmm. which is set in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. And Last Day of School in 1976.
Yeah, another coming-of-age movie. And for a more current version of a coming-of-age tale, I would recommend Booksmart, which is kind of similar and has similarities with one of the movies that I think you were going to recommend.
My addition to that was Superbad, which has a little bit of a mix of both. There's definitely these crazy elements to it with the 2 police officers, the take McGovern on. So there's that part of it. But then there's also the real authentic and genuine part of it in terms of the relationship between the 2 leads.
It's interesting that you mentioned Superbad, because I'm going to mention 6 films, and I actually have talked about them before because we did an episode where we paired Superbad and American Graffiti. The guest was actually in Superbad. He played the security guard at the store where Jonah Hill is thinking about stealing some liquor.
Oh, very cool.
That's awesome.
There are 3 classics and 3 more recent ones, and start with Rebel Without a Cause, which is Nicholas Ray's 1955 film about a group of lost middle-class high schoolers that stars James Dean, Natalie Wood, and Sal Mineo. There's The 400 Blows, Francois Truffaut's 1959 semi-autobiographical classic about a high school teen who, unloved at home, finds himself involved in petty criminal acts. And then there's Murmur of the Heart, Louis Malle's classic, controversial 1971 comedy drama about a teenager from an upper middle-class French bourgeois family and his discovery of sex in a, let's say, not the usual way one loses one's virginity. The more recent ones, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, which is Stephen Chbosky's 2012 adaptation of his own novel about an introverted high schooler who is trying to get his life back on track after attempting suicide. Diary of a Teenage Girl, which is Marianne Hiller's controversial 2015 movie about a high school teen who discovers sex by having an affair with her mother's lover. And then there's Something in the Air, Olivier Assayas's semi-autobiographical 2012 French film about a teenager involved in the anti-war movement in France during the Vietnam War while trying to figure out his future. So what is next? What should we be looking for from you guys?
We'll keep doing the podcast, 80s Movie Montage. We come out with an episode every other week.
Yep.
We have actually, Howard, your episode lined up for later in April, so your listeners can look forward to that as well.
Yes.
Very grateful. We have a short on the film festival circuit right now. She Had It Coming, currently playing this weekend for the McMinnville Short Film Festival, which is up in Oregon. We'll be in a couple next month, one of which is the Women's Comedy Film Festival in Atlanta, which will be a virtual in-person hybrid. If you're not in the Atlanta area, you can still check it out.
And in my other life from being a podcaster, I continue to be an attorney.
For me, I'll go through my usual list. I am a screenwriter and a script consultant, so I have a Howard Kasner Facebook screenplay consultation page. My blog is called Rantings and Ravings, where I deal with issues about screenwriting and movies. I've published two books of short stories on Amazon, The Starving Artist and Other Stories, and The Five Corporations and One True Religion, which are sci-fi, horror, and fantasy short stories. The second edition of my screenwriting book, More Rantings and Ravings of a Screenplay Reader, is also published on Amazon. I'm an amateur photographer, and you can find those on Instagram. The previous podcast was with writer, actor, director, producer Ellen Michelle, where we discussed The Truman Show and Dark City, two films about characters who begin to suspect that their reality is not their reality. And the next episode will be with podcaster Jerry Galanti, where I'm saying that this is when I'm not being very kind to my guest, because we will be discussing True Romance and my very first Godard film to be discussed on this show, Perrault Le Fou. And if you've ever seen a Godard film, you know what I mean when I saying I'm not being particularly kind to this person, but both of
them. Well, that's one we'll definitely have to tune into.
Both movies are about lovers on the run. With that, I very much want to thank you, Anna and Derek, for being a guest on the show.
Thank you for having
us. Howard, this has been such a pleasure. You always are just so welcoming to your guests. Thank you again for having us on for a second time. This has been our honor and pleasure, and we had a great time.